Friedrich List is an economist that you may not have heard of. His famous book is The National System of Political Economy. He was German and was around in the 19th century. He pit himself against the laissez-faire classical economists of the era. And in this video, I'm going to be pitting his arguments up against the most consistent free market libertarian economist I can think of, which is Murray Rothbard, who was de facto the leader of American libertarianism for most of the late 20th century. I have published on Rothbard in this book here, The Defenders of Liberty. I have all of Rothbard's books, although they're in a different library. I have a whole other economic library at home. I don't have those books with me here. But as you can see, there's a whole bit on Rothbard in this book, as well as various other economists. And this book was intended by me as a kind of realist defense of liberalism, human nature, individualism, and property rights. I still broadly accept most of the premises of the Austrian school, although I would no longer consider myself a defender of liberalism, given some of my later work. In this video, what I want to do, though, is, in the interest of value-free analysis, to pit List's arguments from this book up against the objections to those arguments put forward by Murray Rothbard in the second half of the 20th century. And we're going to try to decide together, or I'm going to be asking you, who is more persuasive and why. So to get into this, we need to really understand what List was trying to say. I expect people are already familiar with some degree of classical liberal argumentation or libertarian argumentation, but I will do my best to explain both as we move forward. So the basic argument here is between national power, which is what List was arguing for. He warned that free trade could hollow out nations. Murray Rothbard, however, insisted that government protection is the thing that destroys prosperity ultimately, and that it's the state that is at fault for hollowing out nations, not capitalism or free trade per se. Their clash, I would argue, lies behind many of today's populist revolts. You could argue on either side what has led to deindustrialization in the West, the shift from the Western hegemony into the rise of China and the East Asian tiger economies. We're going to be looking at all of these things. I have picked out 8 core battlegrounds that we're going to be looking at. But first of all, let's get acquainted with our protagonist here. Friedrich List, you can see on the left, he was born in 1789, died in the middle of the 19th century. And really, his whole problem in that era was that the British Empire was pushing free trade. And he was saying, in a nutshell, this may be all well and good for the British Empire, but it's not good for Germany, and here are the reasons why. As against Murray Rothbard, who was working mainly in the second half of the 20th century, although he was born in the 1920s, most of his career was from the 1960s onwards, and he found himself in an America that he felt was drifting away after FDR, after the Second World War. In his view, America had actually drifted from its libertarian free market roots, and he was trying to get back there. So this is going to be kind of an interesting matchup, to say the least. Two titans of political economy going at it here. So before we get into any other differences between List and Rothbard, the first difference has to be at the level of methodology. List was an empiricist. He belonged to something called the German Historical School. And in a nutshell, List argued that, look, before you get to any axiomatic principles, any kind of universal laws, we have to look at what has actually happened and then draw conclusions from hence. So his method was historical, inductive, and empirical. In his argument, the laissez-faire economists, the classical liberals, Adam Smith, Ricardo, and so on, they were guilty of cosmopolitical abstractions. And he had no time for cosmopolitical abstractions because all economies are situated, are embedded, are particular in the real world. So what's the point of these abstractions, he argued. So when you read List, what's quite refreshing about him is that it's very historically grounded. He's always looking at, look, let's cut all the nonsense. What actually happened? And his account of history goes into, you know, very particular power players. And he talks about, the Hanseatic League and sea robbers and all sorts of things in here. And says, look, this is actual real economics, not these abstract mind games played by liberals like John Locke, who invent scenarios, like the state of nature, or, imagined, in the David Ricardo comparative advantage, Portugal producing wine and England producing cloth, almost as if, it's a kind of maths equation. He's like, well, no, the real world's not like that. We have to take everything into account. Murray Rothbard, on the other hand, was a proponent of a priori rationalism. He used axiomatic logic, following his mentor, Ludwig von Mises. This is a deductive methodology. It's known as praxeology, starting from the axiom of human action, humans act, that's the first axiom, and then working deductively and logically from there, from true premises to logical conclusions. Now, this has its strengths because it's extremely consistent and, it is logical. However, you could argue that in the process, it becomes somewhat dogmatically removed from what's actually happening. I will say, however, that in his historical work, Murray Rothbard is very particular. He is always interested in who are the actual power players. And as an economic historian, Rothbard is very much worth reading. From his point of view, though, he's always pointing out how these power dynamics and how politics and various other things corrupt the flow of the free market. So in a way, he's always saying, well, look, the real price signal has been distorted in some way or something has gone wrong here. And then he starts his analysis from hence. List, I would say, would be more likely to say, well, look, this is just the real world. There is no economics without politics. It's all just political economy all the time. So what is the core dispute between the two of them? Well, in List's case, he argues that economics serves the nation. Economics serve the nation itself. The principal unit that we should be thinking of is the nation or the nation state. And the nation should be working towards building unified productive power, not chasing abstract, global or individual gain. States must guide development for collective welfare and long-run strength, according to List. Whereas in Rothbard's view, only individuals, that's individual people, act. Nations can't act, right? Governments in the abstract cannot act. It is individuals, people, doing things. National interest is a rhetorical cover, according to Rothbard, for coercion that favors elites over ordinary consumers and taxpayers. Voluntary exchange benefits everyone, no state is required whatsoever. He actually, Rothbard goes far enough that he becomes what they call an anarcho-capitalist. He doesn't actually believe the state is necessary whatsoever. I would say that in this case, you can see that with a stronger state, populism is explained by List. I would argue that, you know, the lack of robust interventions in the economy have and the fact that the market has been allowed to reign in certain areas has uprooted many industries that used to be there, and runaway immigration is another example. You know, that's basically the market in action. People going where there's low economic opportunity to places where there's high economic opportunity. That's the basic driver of immigration. Various other things, outsourcing, that's the free flow of capital. And all of these things line up, I would argue, with a List's view of things. Whereas in the, you know, proposed anarcho-capitalist state, I mean, I don't really know how Rothbard would suggest controlling immigration or controlling the flow of capital, you know, from one place to the other. And there's one thing that, you know, the market cannot control is just the lay of the land. The fact that there is lots of different countries in the world geographically and lots of different people from lots of different places. Obviously, there's no control over that from the human point of view. So that's not going to stop. I mean, if there was global anarchy, if there were no governments, there's nothing to stop that massive flow of people and all the problems that it causes. It's worth mentioning here that List, his vision was not of a kind of total state, right? He wasn't an absolutist in this sense. What he wanted was a producerist state. And, you know, he didn't advocate for a total lockdown or government controls on the economy. He actually said that it's best internally to have free markets. So List wanted free markets internally, like no internal protections within the nation. What he advocated for was selective protections on key industries that you're trying to grow within the nation. He also says that it is bad policy to regulate everything and to promote everything by employing social powers, where things may better regulate themselves and be better promised by private exertions. So List wasn't saying that the state needs to get involved in every aspect of life, okay, moral matters and things like that. He didn't really advocate for socialist-style welfareism. What he was arguing for was that a robust, state-backed helping of various key industries would be the backbone upon which a nation could be strong. And then if you've got a strong nation, the well-being of the people in that nation will then be looked after as a consequence of that strong backbone. He did argue for certain infrastructure being the core functions of the state, things like building roads and railroads and bridges and schools, all things that Murray Rothbard would be against the state getting involved with. In fact, Rothbard had essays arguing that railroads are better left in private hands, roads are better off being built privately, bridges are better off being built privately. And there are all sorts of esoteric libertarian arguments you can get in over these sorts of topics. List, on the other hand, very German in this view, said, no, the state must be strong in these areas because this is building. Today we'd call it human capital. He called it mental capital. It's like, well, if you're not training your citizens, if you're not pushing them into various different areas using the state, how are they meant to get there alone? Okay. So he saw it as, you know, key infrastructure being very important. But it's not absolutism. Okay, selective interventions in key industries that the government has identified as being the backbone of an economy. he focused on producers, especially industrial producers. He's got a particular argument that industrial, you know, a manufacturing backbone is the thing that's going to see a country through, as opposed to other types of goods. Less on agriculture. He says that agriculture has got all sorts of vulnerabilities, and also certainly not on financial goods or services, or retail or trade or things like that. That's not solid wealth, according to List. They have too many vulnerabilities. And we'll get into some of the specifics in a moment. He viewed the state's role as fostering the collective welfare of all citizens, mainly through national strength, not through, you know, socialist reallocation programs. He did advocate for some sort of safety net, right? So, you know, you're not going to let your citizens starve and go to wreck and ruin. Okay, there's going to be some welfare there. But, his tendencies internally were actually more towards what people would call today austerity. On the second point, productive powers versus exchange values. So if you have a look in the left column here, List's points are that you should invest in industry and skills, schooling, apprenticeships, things like that. These are all things that List strongly supported. You should sacrifice short-term gain to build national capacity. And this would give you, therefore, long-term strength. So even if the government subsidies of a particular industry produces a loss in the short term, in the longer run, you have that stuff. You have a stock of capital, both in terms of the factories, the manufacturing capacity, and the skills, the mental capital, as he calls it, are built up by the fact that you have put money there. On Rothbard's side, he sees only exchange values. He argues that you should let markets allocate free prices. Okay, the signals, therefore show you where allocate needs to be, where resources need to be allocated, and the consumers benefit now. In the long run, those markets will, as they mature, will become more sophisticated and serve more and more needs, according to Say's law. And eventually, you get a spontaneous prosperity for everybody as, you know, the flow of the market solves everybody's different problems. Now, if you have a look at where List's policies have been most directly implemented in history, he certainly has a point that if a government makes an absolute priority of a certain industry, it does lead to pretty robust. I mean, the most famous cases are South Korea. To some extent, Singapore did this. To some extent, all of the so-called tiger economies. China is another one that has adopted a generally speaking Listian economic plan, and they have capacity, they have manufacturing capacity, whereas in the West, you can see that manufacturing has been hollowed out. It's been, you know, the market has been allowed to dictate where factories are, where jobs are, where people are, and that has led to a lot of dislocation and also a lot of political anger as people's ways of life have been uprooted, you know, in what Schumpeter called the creative destruction, the gale of creative destruction, which does create these short-term dislocations. And liberal economists and libertarian economists factor that in. They say, look, this is a necessary cost to pay for the benefit of everybody else. Okay, you've lost your job in the short term, but you will be reallocated to more productive ends, is the argument they make. But of course, somebody who's just lost their job doesn't want to hear that. Or somebody who's lost their town, let's say, to mass immigration, or because of the factory that used to support all the jobs is no longer there, doesn't want to hear that. They mainly have rage against the political class that allowed this to happen. Whereas, of course, in the Listian sense, none of these things actually take place. So I'm broadly speaking, giving this one to List as well. Third, we have the stages of development and targeted protection. So Friedrich List argued that this is often called the infant industry argument. And Rothbard, I know for a fact, in his book, Power and Market, was strongly against this as well. But List argues that you need to protect infant industries. Let's say you're, I don't know, South Korea, and you want to muscle in on Japan's electronics dominance. You want to muscle in on selling, their big company was Samsung. So all the things that Samsung, electronic products, which is what Samsung make, which is what South Korea has exported lots of, in the past 60, 70 years. Well, if you're the South Korean government, you want to get into that and you want to, you can't allow the kind of savagery of the market to dictate what happens without you as the government protecting that infant industry. Otherwise, what will happen is that the foreign competitor that is already dominant in that market is going to absolutely smash you. Okay, in South Korea's case, it would have been Japanese companies. It would have been Sony. It would have been whatever Japanese companies that were big at the time, or it would have been British companies or American companies. So how is Samsung and other companies like that, before they're established, going to get their foot in the door? List argues you need to protect them. Free trade, List argues, is the privilege of the already strong. And this is at the heart of his argument. He's like, look, if you're the British Empire in 1850, right? If you're the British Empire in 1850, yeah, you're the kind of king of the castle. You can preach free trade all day long because you've got the trade network. You've got the giant navy. You've got the East India Company. You've got a foothold in all of these different markets. You've got the monopoly rights on tobacco in this place and tea in this place and oil later on in the Middle East. You know, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. All of these, mining rights in Africa. These are all things that the British Empire advantages, absolute advantages they enjoyed. So if you have all of those advantages, of course you're going to preach free trade. It's in your interest. But List's argument was, look, we're not the British Empire, we're Germany here. And if we go down this route, we are going to be BTFO'd in the layman. That's what List was arguing. And if you can even look at Germany today and see, okay, whether it was Bismarck's Germany, whether it was the Third Reich under Hitler, or whether it is the post-war Germany, the manufacturing base has always been strong. Its educational institutions have always been strong. The German state has always been quite robust in helping its industries. Okay, and that's because this German historical school and the Listian type thinking has predominated in Germany. And you could say, well, that was actually they did lose two world wars, okay, but that's war. In terms of actual economy, if you have a look at what Germany has done, there have been several German economic miracles. Once under Bismarck, once under Hitler, that was the Schacht plan, and then a third time, West Germany, okay, after the war. Three German economic miracles. And even today, Germany has been the powerhouse in the European Union as well. List would argue that it was his ideas, right? If List was alive today, he'd be saying, like, look, Germany would have been absolutely trammeled by the ravages of the market if there had not been a robust German state helping out at different times. He probably would have said that the mid-century Germans, Hitler and friends, probably went a bit far in their market interventions, I'd imagine, that he'd say. But he'd also probably say that the European Union and the West Germany and later the unified Germany under Merkel went too far in liberalization. Okay, Liszt was very much not 100% for the state and not 100% for the market. Very pragmatic. What is Rothbard's counter to all of this? He says that the infant industry argument is a fallacy. Government picks losers. Protection hardens into permanent cronyism. Markets handle new industries more efficiently than government can. And in an absolute sense, he may have a point, Rothbard. Okay, the involvement of governments is probably going to introduce some element of inefficiency, and it is probably going to introduce some element of cronyism. However, the question then becomes, well, where are you getting all the capital required to do all of this? And in some of the cases where you have really quite giant multinational corporations and you're a little fledgling company, let's say in South Korea or let's say in Thailand or China or one of these sorts of places, and you want to get a foothold into the market, well, if you go by private interests, your little company is probably going to get swallowed up by the big behemoth that's already in the market. It's just going to get swallowed up and merged. This has been a problem, I think, in the tech industry in America, where promising companies are just gobbled up by IBM or by Google and so on and so forth, mergers and acquisitions. Whereas if you've got a government saying, no, this is going to be, the Norwegian state-backed company, no private hands can get involved in it. You know, you try to take this, you're going to have to take on the actual national army here. Okay, same in South Korea, same in Japan, same in China. Then it actually clears up some of that kind of capital risk. Basically you're getting the taxpayer to help foot the bill to get this industry up on the road. What do the people get back from it? Well, they get the prosperity and all of the things that industry taking off will bring. Okay, and again, if you think about it from the point of view of people upset that their towns in the Rust Belt in America are no longer there, or people in the valleys of Wales upset that the coal mines are no longer there, or up north in this country, all the factories and steel works and all of the other things that used to be there, the sustained towns that are no longer there, Liszt would say, look, it would be worth the government being involved, at least in the early stages, to help all of those things get up and running. I should mention that one of Liszt's very important points is that the British Empire was a little bit hypocritical in preaching free trade. He points out that in the earliest part of the British Empire, that there was a lot of state-backed, cronyist, kind of monopolistic, they basically, the British state helped out its companies quite a lot up until the era of laissez-faire. Once they had a completely dominant position, then they switched to free trade. And basically the same thing happened with America later on. You know, these are all Steve Bannon's arguments that some people will be familiar with, that in the 19th century, America was pretty Listian, it was pretty protectionist when it came to its own external free trade, and it protected certain industries, the American government did. And it was only when America took over the British Empire that it started really preaching, laissez-faire as a kind of foreign policy doctrine. Liszt argues that manufacturing builds synergies, skills, and national power. Agrarian specialization, however efficient on paper, has long-run dependencies. So this is what I was saying before about how he really thought industry, manufacturing, was the key thing. You can have a lot of farmers, okay, but farming is vulnerable. If you have a look at agrarian-based economies today, you know, I recently talked about a shock to coffee prices on my video yesterday. I talked about a shock on coffee prices. Well, countries that are heavily dependent on that sort of agriculture, you know, something like coffee beans, Brazil, it's less resilient to those sorts of price shocks. It can, you know, drought can happen. You know, it's just a dodgy, the enlist's view, if your economy is based on agriculture, that is not as strong as being based on manufacturing. Manufacturers were the thing. Now, you could argue that from his point of view, writing in the mid-19th century and seeing the might of the British Empire, he would be drawn to think this. I mean, there's one argument to say, well, this is historical contingency. What about today, right? We're fast forward now when there's a lot of financial power. There's been a lot of financialization, that the top economies are no longer industrial, but are post-industrial, etc. I think List would argue, he'd say, well, look at who's changing relative positions, though. Look at now where the manufacturing power is in the Far East. It's in China. It's in, you know, in some of these other Asian economies. Labor is cheaper there. That all of the capital investment goes over there. All of these places are visibly hollowed out. Those countries over here are suffering from political turmoil, political instability, in a way that these economies over here are not. List would say that is because manufacturing is a securer basis for the wealth and prosperity of a nation than finance or services. So I think he would adapt his argument, you know, for the current circumstances. Rothbard, on the other hand, says that comparative advantage rules, that if you force industrialization, you impoverish consumers. Consumers will end up paying more than if you just left it to the market. Services and technology can lead development equally well. One of the counters I'd have to this from Rothbard is that, look, if you are the consumer, let's say in 1990s Britain or America, and South Korea is subsidizing Samsung products, it's subsidizing Samsung, and it's protecting Samsung as well. Now, that means that South Korean people may pay more for their tech, their electronic imports. But it means that the Brits and the Americans and the Europeans who are not putting, they're not protecting their electronic industries, they're just getting the benefit of the South Korean ones. Well, basically what's happening is that the South Koreans are subsidizing cheaper video recorders and camcorders or whatever else, TV sets, for Westerners to buy, if you think about it, okay? But in the process, okay, so it's not, what I'm saying is, it's not always true that subsidies lead to higher prices for consumers. They lead to higher prices in the domestic market. That means the average South Korean would have had to pay more for a Sony television, for example, okay? Not necessarily more for the Samsung TV, note, just for the Sony one. But if you're the Brit or the American, you're probably paying less for that Samsung TV than for a domestic British TV or for, you know, a Sony television, because of the relative, because of that subsidy, you know, allows South Korea to sell that TV set for a lower per unit cost. So if you think about it, so what South Korea government are doing is giving Samsung a competitive advantage that they would not have enjoyed otherwise. What does that do? Think about what it does. It drives out those British manufacturers, American manufacturers, who can no longer compete with Samsung. Now, when I was growing up, I remember There was Philips VHS. Do you remember Philips? There was Philips. There was Ferguson. I had a Ferguson VHS recorder. Well, I don't see those so much anymore. Probably driven out by the competitive and aggressive encroachment of companies like Samsung, because the British government, believing in laissez-faire, believing in free trade, went the Murray Rothbard route. South Korean government went the List route. So the question is, what was actually then best? Well, the British consumer benefited from the South Korean subsidy, because he ended up with a cheaper VHS recorder at the end of the day. But then if you think of the jobs, if you think of the prosperity, if you think of the power, that drained away from Britain and companies like Ferguson and Philips and whoever else, and Sharp, do you remember them? Drained away from those companies and from this country towards South Korea, who are now pretty dominant in that electronics market, along with the Japanese and various other Chinese companies as well. And this would say, well, in the long run, who played it best? South Korea outplayed Britain, List would say. And therefore, I have to give this argument also to List. List captures the backlash of the populists, because also then, if you're the worker at the Ferguson factory or the Sharp factory or the Philips factory, well, you don't have a job anymore. Company you work for has gone bust. I mean, I don't know if all these companies have gone bust, but I don't see them anymore. I still see Samsung, okay? From my lay understanding, I saw those when I was kids. It's a memory to me. I now see Samsung everywhere. But Rothbard is right. The regulation, welfare, and so on, was a part to play. Rothbard would argue, just to give the other side of the ledger, that it wasn't necessarily the free trade policies that did in Western industries, British industry, American industry. It was things like union power, strike action, distortion of wages through labor power and things like this, all of which didn't need to happen and made British industry and American industry less competitive as against their upstart rivals. And I think List would probably concede that, but he'd also say, well, yeah, but your governments did allow those foreign encroachments to come in. They didn't protect those industries. You allowed the competitor to come in. You gave away competitive advantage and you gave it to them over there. That's what List would say. So, there are good arguments coming from Rothbard, but I still overall think List, when it comes to this issue, has the stronger arguments. Now we get to infrastructure, education, and the state's role. As I've talked about, List had this concept of mental capital. Today, people talk about human capital. It's the same idea, really. Rothbard, as ever, believed that the market delivered better. The private competition provides infrastructure and education more efficiently. State monopolies breed waste, political capture, misallocate scarce capital. Also, he had lots of arguments about how mandatory state education was a brainwashing program. He was probably right about that. Whereas List, looking at it from the national perspective, said that the government must invest in railways, schools, skills, and that this productive power in mental capital was absolutely important. Otherwise, you're giving up advantage to rivals. And again, when I have a look at America, which seems to be in decline at the moment, taking on places like China, Russia, and Iran, one of the things that's hard not to notice is just how many engineers per capita China has, Russia has, and Iran has versus America. Now, why is that? That is because the state takes a more active role in skills training in those countries. It directs, the government says, we need lots of engineers. We're going to push people into engineering in these countries versus in America, where it's basically like education is left up to the market. You know, these big Ivy League schools, they charge tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars even, and people are allowed to choose their own path in the individualist way. And you can say, well, has that efficiently allocated the mental capital of the nation? Or have we ended up with too many people doing Mickey Mouse degrees, too many people doing media studies and David Beckham studies and, you know, Lord knows what, you know, dissertations on Harry Potter and so on, and not enough on core engineering skills? Now, there are other arguments from the libertarian point of view, which do have validity. Richard Cantillon argued that when the state starts mandating certain roles, it then misallocates and misjudges it. By the time it gets the program up in action, it tends to promote too many people to those roles. And before you know it, that industry that they've been trained for, circumstances have changed in the real world. And now all of a sudden you've got lots of people with skills that are no longer needed. You could think about in this country, Tony Blair saying 50% of all people must go to university, which you could say was kind of Listian, right? Even though he didn't say what they should be studying, he left that up to the market. But he did say 50% of all people must go to university. And now, fast forward all this time later, there's a massive unemployment crisis among graduates. There's not enough graduate jobs to go around because all of those people didn't necessarily need to go to university. So it's kind of swings and roundabouts. Again, it's kind of, this one I'd say is more of a hybrid. You want the best of the market. You want the advantages that List is talking about for the government providing infrastructure, but somehow you don't want vast waste or vast misallocations that can happen as a result of intervention. So I call that one a tie. List argued that free trade is conditional, not always beneficial. And the thing that he was really revolting against, List, was this notion of universal laws in economics. He's saying, well, look, it really depends on who you are. If you're the British Empire, it's a great idea. If you're America, let's say in the era of George Bush, it's a great idea. If you're Germany in the 19th century, not a great idea. If you're South Korea looking to establish Samsung as a household brand, not a great idea. You need protection. You need something else. You need a government leg up to help push. This was List's basic argument. And, you know, there's an argument to say that too much faith in the market in the West, although the truth of the matter is that the West has had a pretty hybrid model since about the 40s or 50s, which makes this quite a difficult comparison. But comparatively, compared to China, compared to the tiger economies, the West has been relatively more laissez-faire. And you could say, well, that has ravaged industry in those places. So again, it's difficult not to give the argument to List. Of course, the libertarians would say and the Rothbardians would say, well, this is unfair because the West has nothing like the system that Rothbard would have advocated for. None of the things the West has done in the past 200 years can be chalked up to quote-unquote laissez-faire, even at the height of British laissez-faire in the late 19th century. They didn't really have, you know, there were still all sorts of little devices and tariffs and measures that they had in the British Empire as well. You know, they tied wages to the price of coal, for example, by government decree. You know, there was all sorts of things that were not purely free market, which is always the get out of jail free card for the libertarian, because of course they're comparing reality to a utopian fantasy that they have in their mind. On national unity, power, and immigration, List obviously argued for sovereignty first. Economic policy must serve national independence and security. A strong, cohesive nation is the precondition for welfare and liberty. Mass immigration strains cohesion and welfare systems, which is a live driver of populism today. On Rothbard's comeback on this, he says that state power in itself, including immigration restriction, threatens individual liberty. Minimal government maximizes freedom for everybody. National identity is not an economic variable. And again, you could say, well, why are so many people discontent with the political system today? Why is there so much support for people like Nigel Farage in this country, or Donald Trump, or Restore Britain, or any of the populist parties across Europe? Why has there been this anti-immigration backlash? Why is there this sense that there are the people and the elites and so on? And a lot of people would say, well, at the heart of it has been rather too much liberty, too much freedom for capital to kind of have its way with people, with places, with markets, with goods, with services, with capital, you name it, everything. You know, the EU has got these four freedoms, and it's kind of caused, you know, it's caused chaos, really. It's uprooted people. It's led to an increase in what Carlyle called nomadism. And all of these things account for populist discontent. And I don't really know how Rothbard or Rothbardians or libertarians deal with the reality of these things while sticking to their consistent kind of libertarian frame. It seems to me that if you're looking from the modern perspective, List has an explanation. Whereas, you know, for the libertarians, the explanation is always, well, yeah, it's the state's fault. But is it really the state's fault? The state actually got out of the way of a lot of these processes. It got out of the way of so many different things, and yet look at what happened. You could say, well, okay, yeah, but look at welfare. Welfare is a distortive factor when it comes to immigration. Yeah, but lots of immigrants aren't on welfare. Lots of people come to this country and other countries, don't get social housing, don't get benefits, but yet they still move. They still risk life and limb on those little boats to try to get here purely for economic reasons, because the differential in the wage rate is that much higher. Because it's still better for that person to sleep 10, you know, in a semi-legal, you know, flat in London, you know, 10 people sharing one room than it would be back home. It's still better in London than it is back home. That's an economic dislocation. And then the libertarian would say, yeah, but then you have to look at what's like, why is that country like it is back home? Is it because he comes from a socialist place? Is it because he comes from a communist place? You know, maybe, but the argument from this point of view is like, well, why is our government, why Frederick List would say, it's still ultimately up to this government, our government, to stop this happening, to protect the people of this nation from encroachment by randos from around the world. So, yeah, I still think List has the better of it here. Final point, what is the ultimate goal? Is it national strength? Is it global harmony? List argues that prosperous, independent nations are the building blocks of a future of universal benefit. Strength now enables cooperation later on. Rothbard argues, contrary to that, that unhampered global markets create spontaneous order and peace. State intervention, nationalist or otherwise, breed conflict and inefficiency. And I actually got Grok to generate a kind of scorecard out of 10 for performance, for pure free trade, how that's performed historically, pure protectionism, how that's performed historically, the Asian tigers, the post-war Western hybrid, and China, after 1978. You can have a look at the scores that Grok gave there. You can agree or disagree with them. But basically, hybrids seem to outperform pure models. And I should say that List's model was a hybrid one. List actually provides the blueprint closest to what the Tiger economies in China did. Whereas the Western economies are still somewhat underpinned by liberal thinking. I wouldn't say that was true of China or the East Asian Tigers. So the verdict is that pragmatic hybrids win. I would say that List had the better of this argument. I try to give Rothbard his due as we went along. But the fact is, we live in a political world. We do live in a world of nations. And a lot of List's enduring warnings have come to pass. Nations are not interchangeable. The protection of productive capacity is paramount, unless you're going to lose that productive capacity. We have lost a lot of productive capacity due to the lack of protections given to those things. And today, there's still a lot of people getting over this drastic reallocation of capital that's gone on in the world. The opening up of every part of the world to capital, to labor, to markets, to, everything has caused havoc. It's caused a lot of upheaval in people's communities and living situations and prospects in the world. And still, I would argue, even in 2026, the West is coming to terms with the fact that it is miscalculated, because it listened more to liberal economists than it did to people like Friedrich List. Whereas China, it appears to me, seems to be on the upwards ascendancy. I know a lot of people disagree with that. I happen to think their disagreements are cope, as I've said many times. I think that List is somebody worth reading and seriously engaging with and thinking about when it comes to national economic policy. I'd like to see more Listian thinking in general, in America, here in Britain. I'd like to actually see some people, some governments put some of these things into place. Starmer's government has done a little bit here and there, not quite enough in my view. But what do you think? Who do you think are the better of this argument? Was it List or was it Rothbard? I'd love to know. I'm really interested to know your thoughts on this one. Do buy a course at the academic agency. The Ultra Bundle is available today. I'll let the ad play us out and I'll catch you all next time.
Ultra Bundle! 7 courses. Shakespeare! Research! The Trivium! Economics! Politics! The Ultra Bundle! Buy it now!
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.